This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Can you have a home-style birth but at hospital? And if a woman in labour refuses medical intervention in hospital, even if it puts her or her unborn baby at risk, hospital staff will now have to do what she asks, no matter what the consequences are. That's because there are new guidelines for doctors and midwives to support women in hospital who refuse medical treatment during pregnancy and birth, even if it does risk their health or potentially harming their unborn child. For example, the new guidelines state that in these high-risk moments, staff are instructed to respectfully inform the woman that permanent harm may not be avoidable whilst continuing to provide support without intervention. In cases where women refuse medical treatment, these new guidelines now advise hospitals to reduce the number of staff in the room, keep an emergency team on standby in case the mother changes her mind, and appoint a scribe to document the conversations. So are you about to give birth? Have you thought about whether or not you would like medical intervention? Are you a midwife or an obstetrician? How do you feel about these new guidelines? How much have you read them? How much do you understand them? And are you noticing more women coming into hospital who don't want medical treatment during childbirth? And from birth to death, funerals are expensive, but we've started to see some cheaper disruptors. So are you a traditional funeral director? And what does your job involve? What skill does it take?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So before modern medicine, it wasn't uncommon for women to die during childbirth. But thank goodness things have changed. There are a growing number of women now who want to have a medical-free birth, and changes to guidelines now support that. So are you about to give birth? Have you thought about whether or not you would like medical intervention? If you're a midwife or as an obstetrician, how do you feel about the new guidelines? And are you noticing more women who don't want medical treatment during childbirth? Dr. Nisha Kott is the president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Kott, a warm welcome to The Conversation Hour. Can you just sort
Thank
of give
you
us
very
a,
much for having me.
Give us a summary of what these new guidelines look like?
So these guidelines provide a framework for clinicians and women to have the sorts of conversations that will guide decision making. It's really important to first of all recognize that women also want the best experience for their pregnancy and the best outcomes for themselves and their babies. And so it's, you know, it's not like women don't want that. But what this guideline provides is a framework to have those discussions where women's choices can be respected, risks can be discussed in a respectful manner that women won't perceive as being coercive. And both the clinician and the woman in front of her, the family with her, can reach a decision that works best for the woman.
Can I just pick up on something that you said there, Nisha, with, you know, because let's face facts, giving birth is stressful. Very rarely is it easy and quick and pain-free. You're under a lot of stress. You may change your mind. You may have thoughts and ideas of what giving birth will be like. Your so-called birthing plan quite often just goes out the window when you are in the eye of the storm of being in labour. But when you said then that they are being coerced into a decision, is that a growing concern for women who are giving birth? And is that a part of the reason why these guidelines have come in? Because women feel like they are being talked into medical treatment during childbirth, even if they thought prior they didn't want any kind of medical intervention?
It's a really tough one, isn't it? As a clinician, I want to give women information that will help them make the decision that they feel is right for them. Now, the way I frame it could be seen as being coercive, or it could be seen as being helpful and supportive. And I think that's where these guidelines come in, that they give clinicians the language and the framework that is supportive rather than coercive. Because let's be honest, as clinicians, we don't want to coerce or force women to have interventions that they don't want, but we do want women to realize why we are recommending a particular intervention, what the risks are of having it, what the risks are of not having it, and then, you know, support them to make the decision that would be the right for them.
Is there growing concern, tension within the hospital settings of more women wanting or thinking that they want a medical-free birth? Is this causing any tension between staff and patients in any way?
I think it would be dishonest to say that there is intention. There is tension, and anybody who's worked in the maternity sector over the last decade or longer will have noticed that that tension is getting more difficult to manage if we are not all on board with what the framework should be for managing it. And so, yes, there is tension. But this is about making sure that we all continue to have respect at the centre of all our interactions.
This text, my cervix stopped opening, so I had to have an emergency Caesar after 12 hours of labour. There is an element of trust in your doctor as well as good communication. Nobody thinks they're going to have an issue, but they do occur. Nisha, women may go in to hospital with all best intentions, saying, I don't want any medical treatment, I don't want any medical intervention, and then may want to change their mind at the time. But how do you navigate that? How do you negotiate that? Or how do you convince a woman who said, no, I'm going to be letting myself down. I said I wasn't going to have any medical intervention. I was going to have a natural birth. And there's rising conversations around that. How do you then talk to a woman openly and honestly about the risks of not having medical intervention in really stressful environment?
Correct. And I think that is the key to it, that we should not be having these conversations for the first time in really stressful environments. Let's be honest, women don't just come in and have babies. They've been pregnant for 9 months. They have had ample opportunity to have these discussions with their doctors and midwives. And I think that is the key to it, that we have these discussions during pregnancy, during those antenatal appointments where we see women. This is where continuity of care comes in and is so important. When you see the same doctor or the same midwife for your appointments throughout pregnancy, you can have a continuum of a discussion. You start with one subject, you can move on to the next, and you can have detailed discussions about what their preferences might be. And it gives doctors and midwives the opportunity to say to women, yes, we respect, you know, your decision, but here's something that may happen, which may need to prompt a change in the plan. How do you think we should go about doing that? Those are the sorts of things we can discuss during pregnancy. Of course, you know, we realize that realistically that sometimes doesn't happen, and we do get to the pointy end, the stressful situation in which we do have to make decisions. Again, it's a, you know, time to take a deep breath, calm down and have a calm discussion. Give it some time, allow the woman and the partner and family to have a think about what you've discussed, go back to it. Within maternity, we do kind of have emergencies that need to be addressed really quickly, but not everything is an emergency that needs addressing within seconds or minutes.
Let's have a chat to Ella, who's in Anglesey. Good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Really well. What did you want to share?
So I'm due in a couple of months with my second.
And congrats.
Thank you. I think there's a lot of negative birth stories out there relating to the medical system and how it kind of takes, like women might feel like their power is being taken away and their inner wisdom and their sense of we've been doing this for millions and millions of years.
I find that interesting, Ella. Like with, let's say if you were going to have a tooth extracted and the same judgment was put onto you because you didn't want pain relief to get that tooth pulled out. Yeah. Why is it? Because I was like, get that epidural in my back the moment I walked in there. What pain relief have you got? Give it to me now. Yeah. But there, I did cop a bit of flack for that. So why is giving birth different? Why is it supposed to be seen as just simple and natural and easy? And are we judged if we choose to have medical intervention or not, do you think, Ella?
I would hate to think that you are judged, because it is all completely personal to you. The only thing that I think is there's a lack of birth education available for women and their partners that is at an affordable price. We did a calm birth course, which was about $550, which went over a couple of weekends. That just reinforced my inner sense of power that I have. However, we did have an obstetrician. We were in the private medical system, and I knew that I wanted to have my baby in the hospital. However, there were points where I could say, I need more time. Like, I felt like doing that course helped me, gave me reassurance, but I would never, ever put my child at risk and myself at risk because I didn't trust the medical system, because it's there for a reason.
I wish you all the best with your second birth, Ella. Thank you. I want to get your thoughts on that in just a moment, Nisha, when it comes to education. But Sam's in Beaumont. And Sam, you've just finished that course that Ella was talking about, you and your wife.
Yeah, we have. It was probably the best thing that we've done so far in this lead up to our birth. This is our first child. And I just found that the information that we've received through the Calm Birth basically just debunked a whole heap of stuff that I guess most of us have learnt through Hollywood movies and all that sort of random crap. Like, it's just, birth is not what it is. And to be honest, like, it also involves the partner. And I think as a partner, we need to be there. We are the biggest advocate for our birth partner. So we really need to be on top of what we need to be talking about, what the birth plan is, but also, like, understand those changes as they come, because anything could happen. We just don't know. And as the last caller said, like, the medical system's there for a reason. We need to understand why we're saying yes to those interventions if they are required. So that's pretty much where we come from now.
So when's your wife due, Sam?
Less than a month to go now. So it could be any day from next week through to, I don't know, end of Feb. So
anytime your phone rings or pings, that you're...
Pretty much. Yeah.
Oh, I wish you all the best, mate. How are you feeling?
Bloody excited. Pretty keen for it.
Oh, you're going to have the best time. Sam, thank you. Dr. Nisha Cott is with you, President of the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. We're talking about the changes to guidelines when it comes to mothers having more say and control over medical intervention in hospital when they're giving birth. Is education key, Nisha, and is it enough at the moment for mums and for partners? And I guess that's on both sides, what to expect, but also know when to take medical advice and not be like, well, I always thought this was going to be how it was and I'm going to stick to my guns. So is education key?
Absolutely. Education is the most important and most effective thing that we can do during pregnancy, which will help with all of this decision making. What I find sometimes is that the education, whatever is available out there, is good and helps women and partners. But what it sometimes doesn't address is exactly what you've said. When does the plan need to change? When do we need to do things differently? And what that looks like. And I think that is a missing piece of education that we really should be providing to all women and their partners.
Let's have a chat to Greg, who's in Kyabram. Good morning.
How are you?
Really well. What did you want to share?
Yeah, I'm a bit excited like the previous caller, but I'm expecting the birth of my first grandchild in 6 weeks. So,
great.
Oh, hello. I've got a fish on the line. I better go. Sorry.
Are you actually fishing at the moment?
Fishing up.
All right. Call us back. Let us know how you go.
Two 200 years ago, childbirth was one of the biggest killers for women.
Yes.
Oh, the fish is gone.
But, Greg, I was holding my breath. Yeah, okay, sorry about that.
And when my own children were about to be born, I was horrified at the number of things that could go wrong at birth. And it's a very vulnerable moment for a woman and a newborn. And I just think you can have the best intentions, but you listen to medical advice. They're the experts. They see lots of it. I just worry about a woman can come in and with their intentions, you can change your mind if you during the
absolutely
birth.
Yeah,
it's so risky, and there's two people involved. So I love the idea of having a plan, but if things go wrong, take the advice, please.
Chuck the plan out. Hey, Greg, get back to fishing. All right. What a great day you're having.
It's gone.
All right, mate. What a multitasker. Dr. Nisha Kot is with you. I reckon in 20 years of broadcasting, that's the first time I've been live to air with someone fishing who, you know, one got away. But anyway, Greg's back in Kyabram. Having best intentions, but then being able to throw that plan out. There are so many texts along the similar line here. I guess what reaction have you had from medical staff, from midwives, for example, to the changes to these guidelines? Are they happy about it? Do they know about it?
I think they have only been recently released, so, you know, people are getting to know them. They're very welcome because ultimately we want to have conversations that help women make decisions, and we want to have helpful conversations. We as clinicians, whether we are doctors or midwives, don't want to come across as uncaring or disrespectful. And so anything that helps us have that conversation in a better way is going to be welcome.
This, and I agree with this, unfortunately, women are disappointed by their birth experience as they have unreal expectations around the idea of giving birth and a birth plan. More information of what can go wrong should be given in some of these antenatal classes. Giving birth is natural, but dying from childbirth is also natural. So that idea of whether it be Hollywood or influencers of not, I guess, having an unrealistic expectation of what giving birth looks like. Just finally, Dr. Nisha Kot, some have said that these guidelines have kind of just slipped through, that not a lot of people know about them. Do enough people, whether it be birthing mothers or practitioners, is everybody kind of on the same page here with the changes to these guidelines?
Well, guidelines do take time to filter down to everybody who is providing care and also to women, but I'm sure that these will get to everyone who is involved in maternity care as well as to women and partners and will be effective and useful.
Just finally, are you happy with the changes?
Like I said, these are things that we have been doing. This is a framework to make sure that we do it in a better way. You know, over the years, we have always wanted to have respectful conversations. We've always wanted to support women in their choices. It's just that this guideline provides us with a framework for doing it.
Great to get your thoughts, Nisha. Thank you. Dr. Nisha Kot, President of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Coming up in just a moment, one of my favourite topics and pastimes, and that is potato crisps. But when do they get so fancy? When do they get so expensive? And when do they start to be listed on menus as appetizers?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So I haven't met a potato crisp that I haven't liked, let's say loved. Potato chips are quite possibly one of my favourite things to eat, to buy. I have multiple flavours in the pantry at the moment. But have you noticed how fancy chips have become? Not just the flavours, everything from, you know, dill pickle to jalapeno and cheese, but you've got all different types of techniques. The potato origin and the backstory is on the back of the packet, to the point where packaging has changed so much that now potato chips can even come in tins. And don't be surprised if a packet of chips will cost you, you know, $10 or more. So gone are the days of just, you know, barbecue, salt and vinegar and chicken. 1-300-222-774 if you've been eating way too many crisps. The woman who I had to have join me on this conversation, none other than Danny Valent, food writer, host of the podcast Dirty Linen. Danny, you and I are both potato crisp lovers. Before we get into the rise and the rise of loaded potato crisps, which have replaced my cheese board this summer, just quietly, and I am winning a lot of friends. What's going on with potato chips, even on menus now, listed as an appetizer, and they just come out like in the packet?
Well, Rish, I know that this whole segment is really just to endorse your life choices, and I am so there for that. I'm really, really happy to help. I think, you know, a lot of foods and snack foods are certainly not immune. We're just seeing a sort of premiumization of them. It's like, how can we upscale this? How can we turn this into something that's a bit more fancy? How can we encourage consumers to spend a couple of extra bucks on something? So, I think it's all about bringing flavours that we might have in restaurants, in other foods, into the chip packet. So, yeah, we're talking about things like Japanese fried chicken, but as a chip flavour.
I'm Wagyu, there for that.
Wagyu beef and blue cheese, but as a chip flavour.
Yep.
So it's, this is your shopping list, actually, isn't it?
That's how I get my protein, beef-flavoured chips, right?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to offer medical advice. You've already had a doctor on the hour today, so we'll just let that one slide by. But, it's all about flavour. It's all about snacking. I'd say you can get your healthy choices elsewhere in your day. But, chips are a perennial favourite for good reason. And I think if we can get more flavour into them, then so much the better.
So the rise of the loaded crisp. So Look, I'm going to tell the truth. I saw this on Instagram and I went, oh, that looks delicious, like cheese and chips in the one dish. And I said to my girlfriend, we have a friend's Christmas party every year, a beautiful garden party. And I said, okay, no cheese board this year. I'm going to do two huge platters of loaded crisps. Not only did they look like the Instagram posts, so I was very proud of myself. They were a hit. So you can put anything on them. I did green olives, some pickled chili, chorizo, blue cheese, grated pecorino on right at the end. I think I might have even had some finely chopped parsley. Are loaded crisps taking over cheese boards, Danny Valent?
Yeah, well, I reckon they could be. I don't know if they're taking over, but they certainly are a great option, whether you call them loaded crisps, loaded chippies, or chip cootery, which I find quite cute and fun. They're definitely easy, and they are a talking point. I think we've probably started
seeing
them about
it. They look good, too.
They look really good and they're very flexible. So as you say, you can kind of put anything on them, anything you'd put on a charcuterie board, you can sprinkle over your chips. And I think, it probably started seeing it sweep through social media about a year ago, and it's only just kept gaining momentum. I think especially as summer comes around and you're looking for an easy snack, even something that's very portable, you could just stuff a bag of chips in your bag or your picnic hamper and the other ingredients. You know, nothing's going soggy. You can just put it all together at the last minute. It's easy to throw together. It's not like things on crackers where you really have to assemble. You can just more go for the scatter, the real casual feel. And, it looks really good. It's easy. Easy to eat, it stays crunchy, and it's just flavour plus.
It is. It's the texture, it's the combination. If you haven't tried it and you're wondering why I'm gushing about this, I mean, it's been on Instagram for a year. It takes me a while to get onto a trend, let's face facts, but it's worth it. Steve in Warrnambool says, not crisps, they're chips. Steve, look, I would normally agree. However, you almost have to call them crisps now because I wanted, oh my God, this is too much detail. Anyhow, the other weekend, I actually wanted chips, as in hot chips, but I said, can we have some chips, please? And crisps came out. So you actually have to call them crisps now, Danny. I mean, look, who's going to complain if a bowl of hot chips comes out to you instead? But there's chips and then there's crisps and there's chips and then there's fries and the world has gone topsy-turvy.
Well, basically, we are loading potatoes no matter what form they come in, because loaded fries is definitely a thing. So you've got your HSPs, your halal snack packs, and all kinds of, loaded fries. But I mean, look, I hate letting go of the Australian expressions, but I think you want the chips that you want for the occasion that you want. And although you could do the chip cootery with hot chips, it's not going to have the same.
No, so, I can't do loaded hot chips. I have my line and I think hot, loaded. No, I can't. I'm not sure why I draw the line there, but I do. Danny Valent is with you, food writer and host of the podcast Dirty Linen. And we're talking chips, as in crisps. And just how fancy they have become, the flavours that are now being offered, and how they are the new cheese plate. Danny, you also, and you've pulled over to talk to us because you're busy doing a lot of food tours at the moment. But what I love about your food tours is that you do them in suburban Melbourne, down high streets of the suburbs that we may have grew up in or that we may live in. And you're now, I think, working on one in Clayton. What's so special about food in Clayton at the moment?
Oh, Clayton's such an interesting suburb. So certainly it expresses different layers of migration. So you've got some Italian, you've got a lot of different Asian, you've got some Indian food coming through, some Korean. It's basically got everything, all different kinds of regional Chinese. And I really see it as, you know, one of my missions, as well as, you know, working out what to put on chips or crisps. One of my missions is to bring people together around food and exploring different cultures, bringing people together around a table to find out all the things that we have in common, as well as the things that make us beautiful and different. So I love leading food tours around Melbourne's neighbourhoods. So I'm rolling out a few different ones this year, but the first one is Clayton. And yeah, they're on sale now. So if anyone wants to head to my website, dannyvallant.com, or my Instagram, send me a message through the website and I'll send you the link to buy tickets, or just I've got the link in my Instagram as well. And I would love to see you there. It's a few hours of roaming suburban streets in Melbourne, eating all the things and learning about different cultures. I think it's one of the things that makes Melbourne special, and I'm so excited to unlock it for people.
Always good to speak with you, Danny. Thank you. Danny Vallant, food writer and host of the podcast Dirty Linen.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Some of the chip flavours that are coming through. Are we really meant to be taking this seriously? And there's a picture of a chip flavour, applewood, smoked butter and sea salt. Smoked butter and sea salt. Look, I'd give it a try. All right. I'm just saying. So are you one of the tens of thousands that are heading to the tennis today? Did you go yesterday? Is it on your schedule? Who are you looking forward to seeing? Ned Hall, part of our ABC tennis commentary team. Ned, it's just been incredible this year to watch the rise and the rise of fans and spectators and the hype around the tennis. It's another beautiful day in Melbourne. How's the day shaping up already?
Look, Michelle, it is. It's a stunning day out here again. And I've been out here for a few hours. And when I was coming here, the gates weren't open, but the queues outside already were enormous. It does feel like there's a real buzz around the tennis this year. There's lots of people coming in from overseas. And people are really enjoying the whole sort of festival of tennis idea. I actually was down here last week whilst everything was getting set up down here. And there was practice matches taking place out on centre court. I saw Jannik Sinner having a hit out there against Felix Auger-Aliassime. It was full. And this is on the Friday before the tournament's getting underway. So it's a real... they've really expanded the tournament out into making it a big event, which is... obviously, it's a Grand Slam tennis event, but it feels a bit bigger than that this year.
So who are people looking forward to watching today? And is there any sort of surprises that you think that will come through today, Ned?
Well, look, today, I'll start off focusing on the Australian challenge today, because in these early rounds, obviously, you get a bigger number of Australians playing. There was 9 yesterday, 6 made it through, including Alex de Minaur. Unfortunately, late last night, Alex de Popperin didn't make it through. Currently on court, currently a break of serve down, although she has got a break point now, is the top-ranked Australian women's player at the moment, and that is Maya Joint, the 19-year-old. She's just made it into the top 30 in the world. She's just broken serve and broken back against the Czech player Tereza Valentova, so it's 3-all in the first set there. Now, quite high hopes for Maya Joint, but she's so early on in her career that I think a lot of people are keen to see how far she can go and whether she is up to the calibre of the very leading players in the game. You would hope she can get through against an unseeded Czech player in this first round, make it through to the second round and have a proper tilt at this Grand Slam. Elsewhere, there will be an Australian getting through into the second round, because on the same court this evening, Madison Inglis is taking on Kim Birrell. So two Australians up against each other. One goes out, one will at least be into the second round. We've also got Taylor Preston on court now against the Chinese player Shuai Jiang. She's actually a breakup in the first set, so that's good news. She was a wild card into the tournament. And one of the qualifiers, Australian male player Dane Sweeney, is playing the 39-year-old Gail Monfils. not the oldest player in the draw. Yesterday we had Stan Wawrinka at 40 years of age, who won and made it through to the second round. But I think we're seeing a few more of these players extending their careers and playing on into the late 30s,
absolutely.
Early 40s.
Yeah, 39. Yeah. I mean, we were talking about Venus Williams, you know, being 45, and I just wonder whether we'll start to see more and more of that. I know this was a couple of days ago, Ned Hall, but when we saw the young ball kid, I think, faint almost due to heat and being on court for a long time, it is hot out there. I mean, we do really take our hat off more and more to the work, to the dedication, to the amount of young kids that put their hands up to volunteer to be ball kids. But are they all okay at the moment? Like, are they drinking enough water? Are they getting looked after?
Look, they are, and I think they have to be very on the ball with that, the organisers of the tournament, to make sure that, as you say, that they're drinking water, they're taking enough breaks. They do change them over at various different stages during the match. At the moment, it isn't super hot. It's going to get hotter later on this week. I think it's going to hit 39 degrees on Saturday. So that is one of the days when there is sort of real pressure points where play could well be suspended. Because 39 degrees outside, you can probably add at least another 10 degrees to what it's like on court, particularly those big show courts where it really keeps the heat inside. But just walking in here today, it was probably low 20s, and it felt hot walking around the sort of the tennis precinct that does tend to generate a lot of heat. Yesterday, there was an issue with one of the players. Priscilla Hond, the Australian player, did make it through to the second round. She was taking on a Canadian, Marina Stakusic, who literally got wheeled off the court at the end, had a medical timeout, collapsed with severe cramps and couldn't keep going. But again, that's a lot down to heat, not being hydrated, etc., all those sorts of things. So I think for some players, and particularly, you've got to think, we're coming in now in the first Grand Slam of the year, we're still in January. A lot of these players have come from the Northern Hemisphere winter, where I know they've been out here for a little while, but they've come from freezing temperatures to an Australian summer, and the heat that they'll be enduring here is a lot more than they would be having to deal with when they're back home in their home countries, in summer, particularly somewhere like Canada at the moment.
Absolutely. And we're known for a lot of things, the Australian Open, but I think the heat and just how full on it is and how hot it can get, we've known that for years and years. And unfortunately, as a result of climate change, it's just going to get hotter. Just quickly, Ned, because I know you're busy and you've got a game to call, a match to call. Novak Djokovic, I mean, you cannot underestimate that man. I mean, he's just spent days saying, oh, you know, I don't think I'm at my best. I don't think I'm at my prime. Is this all part of his plan, do you reckon?
Do you know, it's interesting you say that, because the amount of times over the years you've seen Novak Djokovic go into tournaments carrying an injury or in matches having to get medical timeouts. He breezed through his match last night against Martinez of Spain. Straight sets, 6-3, 6-2, 6-2. And so he didn't really have an issue at all in that match. His 100th win at a Grand Slam. Great stat that came out of this last night. He's lost 10 matches at Melbourne Park. He's won 10 Grand Slams. So he's lost as many matches playing out here as he has won Grand Slams. So 10 out of 100 is not a bad record, the amount of wins that he's had. I don't think he's the number 4 seed. I don't think we're going to see him pushing all the way through to the final because, unfortunately, I think we saw signs of this last year. The two young guns, Alcaraz and Sinner, have gone past him now. They're basically where he was with Nadal and Federer over the rest of the tennis world. So, yeah, I think Djokovic is probably a little touch behind them. There's a big drop-off behind 1 and 2 in the world, even to Zverev, the number 3 seed in the men's draw. But you can
never say never
with Novak Djokovic. And just before I duck off, I can tell you that Maya Joint just held her serve, so she now leads 4-3 on serve in the first set. Valentova, her opponent, is sitting with a towel over her head at the moment. That just probably is an indication of how hot she's finding it out on court at the moment.
Have a great call, Ned. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Ned Hall, part of ABC Sport, part of our ABC tennis team. You can catch all of the action. We've got plenty of crosses. We've got live OBs for you. And, of course, there's always the tennis app and the ABC Sports app as well. This, the dark uniforms for the ball kids, doesn't help. That's a bad design.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Yeah, quite a few comments talking about the ball kids uniform, and having navy or having a dark uniform is just ridiculous on a hot court. And I wonder how long, I'm trying to think back to the AO last year, for whatever reason I thought that was the lighter, brighter blue. But that's a really good point. I wonder whether or not they should look at changing the uniform. What do you think? 1-300-222-774. Should they be in white or a really light colour that doesn't hold the heat? If there is a ball kid in your household, give us a call. Well, we started the show by talking about birth. Now let's move to the other end, to death. So the funeral sector, the funeral directors sector, does it need a disruptor? So if you have planned, if you have held or organised a funeral for anyone of late, you would know that it's expensive. But if you are a funeral director, I would love to hear from you, because what does your job involve? What does it take to be a funeral director? And are you concerned that some funeral directors are saying that the Wild West is opening up in the so-called death trade, that we have people who aren't so-called or trained funeral directors coming in and offering the same service? But maybe is that what the industry needs? Dr. Hannah Gould is a cultural anthropologist and works with the Death Tech Team, the research team at Melbourne University. Hannah, look, I will put it out there. My grandfather was a funeral director, so I come from a long line of funeral directors. We had the grey phone in Nan and Pa's house, where if that rang, it was the death phone and you didn't answer it. And as kids, you kind of panicked and you ran around and you had to go find Pa and say, the phone is ringing, the phone is ringing. But we knew his role, we knew his importance, we knew how people relied on him, and you also knew the type of person it took to be a funeral director. But some are worried that disruptors and so-called cowboys are coming in to the industry. Is it a concern?
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Look, we've seen a huge shift basically from the kind of mum and pop owned businesses, as you described there, where you have maybe one funeral director or a few funeral directors that service a local community directly, and you know who they are and they've been in the community for a long time and you have that level of trust between the family. And we've seen that shift away towards more kind of multinational and really large organisations. And also these organisations that maybe are big brands that own multiple different funeral homes or even outsource a lot of those responsibilities to other operators, all without the families or the communities exactly knowing who it is that's going to be caring for the dead. And I think that opens up a lot of potential for perhaps less good care and some concerning trends that are emerging.
I can see both sides. One, they're very expensive, and that maybe funeral directors have had a monopoly, so to speak, of the sector for a very long time, that there weren't a lot of choices. But at the same time, it is a skill, it is a profession, it's often generational. But then at the same time, I say, well, you know what, maybe there is a way to do it cheaper and still do it with dignity and respect and still offer a really good service. Can the two live, you know, side by side?
Oh, 100%. And I think the question is not necessarily, I mean, obviously it costs a lot of money, but the more concern is that you want to make sure that the standards are meeting that cost, right? So we currently have a situation across most of Australia where the funeral director sector is largely unlicensed and unregulated. So you can't, for example, you know, make a complaint against a funeral director and have them strip them of their license to be a funeral director.
Really?
Because there's simply no such thing. No, there's no such thing. It's actually quite terrifying that the
wow.
lack of regulation.
Because there's a question here that says, do funeral directors have to be registered? So the answer would be no.
Different states and territories vary, and there is some extent which you have to register the business as a funeral director. But in terms of, you know, mandatory qualifications and training, or exactly that kind of thing of, you know, being able to make a complaint to a regulatory board and having that director or company, you know, stop from organizing funerals in the future, that's just not possible in Australia.
So there's no, you don't need to prove that you're a fit and proper person, like, say, with a lot of other sectors. There is
no, and I think because people are so uncomfortable to talk about death, even our polys, like it's really, really hard to push for regulation in this area. Like, I know none of us want to talk about it, but because none of us want to talk about it, it means that there hasn't been regulation in this way. And it means we've kind of just abandoned our responsibility to make sure that people are getting good quality care.
Dr. Hannah Gould is with you, a cultural anthropologist, a part of the Death Tech Research Team at Melbourne University. Do people realise the skill that it takes to be a good, when I say funeral director, that can come in sort of, I guess, any form really now. Even the disruptors may be very good at what they do and they're wanting to do things differently. But it takes a certain skill to be able to sit with people, to help people, to advise people in really traumatic, sad times.
100%. And I think the saddest thing about the lack of regulation and standards is it really, you know, reflects poorly on the good operators, many of whom are out there who do a job that frankly is not paid so well, is highly stigmatized and requires a lot of skill. And it requires also a lot of different services. So part of it is sitting with families and making arrangements, and part of it is perhaps organizing the celebration of life or the funeral. And then the other part of it is, you know, picking up the body from the home or the aged care home, washing and dressing and preparing that body, you know, taking it for viewings or taking it to the crematorium or the cemetery. So it's a huge like range of different skills that are involved in that, and you know, they should be recognized for those skills and, you know, remunerated accordingly. And it's the sad thing that because we don't have these regulations, that we also kind of tend to undervalue these people and the role they play in our society.
Stay with us, Hannah. Carly Dalton is a business owner of Green Haven Funerals. Carly, the skill, the mannerisms, the training, the regulation that isn't there, we've discovered today, that comes in to being a funeral director. Do we underestimate the work that you do?
Look, you know, when you consider that the role of a funeral director is almost like the last piece of the healthcare system. When, you know, the hospitals, the doctors can no longer, you know, provide you with any support and you pass away, we are there to look after people's mortal remains. Now, this is an industry that does not require any formal qualifications. It doesn't require any certification. It doesn't require any licensing. And it's a job that it is work that is largely learnt on the job. And what that means is it attracts lots of different sorts of people from lots of different sorts of backgrounds. And the level of competency is really, it ranges from people who are amazing at this work to people who have no idea what they are doing.
So if we're seeing disruptors, that can be good in that it gives people more options. We're seeing people wanting different types of funerals now, from more low-key to being in pubs to being more environmentally friendly, you name it. However, with more choice comes people getting into it for all the wrong reasons. And then if there is no regulator, where do we stand if something goes pear-shaped, if you don't get the service that you required, and you can be talking about quite potentially the remains of a loved one. What? How do you get? I'm quite shocked by this, Carly. I mean, how do we get the sector to be regulated? Have you been calling for regulation?
I think the industry has been calling for regulation for years. We've been going for, you know, almost 15 years, and ever since we've started, you know, there has been, you know, requests from many of the different organisations and the industry professional groups for regulation. But the fact of the matter is the government is not interested. They are not interested. It is just too hard. It's not a vote, you know, something that's going to capture votes for them. When we set up our facility, you know, we invested a lot of money, and it took me a day of ringing around to seeing if there was any government body that was interested in providing me with some standard guidelines to set up my mortuary. You know, no one was interested, not the local council, not the Department of Health, no one. And in the end, I went to an industrial plumber, and he said, set it up like an abattoir. And I said, what do you think goes on here? You know, and he said, well, I don't know how else. I said, well, surely there is, you know, the hospitals have some sort of regulations. He goes, look, I don't know. No one cares. You know,
wow.
And it's bizarre. When you think about the important work that we do, the care we provide, you know, when we're one of very few independent funeral homes in Melbourne who've actually invested quite a lot of money in setting up beautiful premises, you know, facilities that, you know, state-of-the-art, you know, all the best equipment, but no one cares. No one cares. It's really quite sad.
Carly, know? Stay with us. Hannah, Dr. Hannah Gould, unfortunately, will it take something to go wrong, something to go pear-shaped for someone to come out and say, this happened because I used a dodgy, you know, so-called funeral director or funeral service provider, and it will take something to go pear-shaped for there to be a task force or a commission or something to be set up and for some type of legal framework to be created?
Look, I really hope not, because there are actually have been many cases of things going wrong. Like, we've had multiple investigations, you know, of problems with transportation of remains, with how remains have been stored, you know, with missing remains, with personal possessions being stolen from bodies, with, you know, poor standards, all of these kind of things. And every time it comes into the news, I think, well, now this might be the time when finally, you know, we see regulation. And it's just so disappointing that it hasn't happened yet. It just seems like no one wants to care because nobody wants to think about it. But even, you know, with that kind of analogy to an abattoir, you know, unfortunately, even if you don't really want to know what happens in an abattoir.
Yeah, it's actually similar. Yeah.
Hopefully everyone would like to know that that happens well, right, that there are standards. And unfortunately, the case is that there are more standards today about what happens in abattoirs than there are about what happens in funeral homes.
Wow, I never thought I would have to be drawing the conclusion between a funeral home and an abattoir, and yet here we are. Carly.
It's distasteful, but it's important,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, 100%. No, I think it's so important. I couldn't agree more. I look back at my grandfather and the type of funeral director he was, and the type of man that he was, and the two kind of go hand in hand, actually. But what made you want to be a funeral director?
When my father passed away 22 years ago, and the funeral director that, and I had no experience, I was the typical example of my clients now, you know, that never done this sort of thing before, never had to arrange a funeral. So I went into it blind, engaged the local funeral director, who could not be less interested. I was asked, how much money do I have? I was asked, where's the body? I was asked, you know, I'll ring you back and I'll fit you in sometime next week, or told that. You know, there was no personalization. There was no referring to my dad as Max, not the body. There was nothing. And it was not even like the money thing was the first question. It was not, what would you like to do for your dad, you know? So I thought, gee, how difficult would it be to actually care, to actually listen to the family and see what would you like to do to celebrate your loved one's life? It's not a hard thing to do or a hard question to ask. So I was very motivated. I thought the industry was just full of, you know, grumpy old men, which it was, and it needed a change. And still, you know, it wasn't difficult to break into the industry, because people were screaming out for a different level of care and a different level of personalization, and they want to be listened to. And you know what? It's the best work I've ever done. I love every minute of it. I've been doing it for 15 years. I will do it until I retire. But, you know, you're looking after families, you're creating these beautiful events that meet their needs, and, you know, and you're just listening to what they want and delivering on that. And as part of that, you know, we have a beautiful facility, which we're very proud of, very transparent. And I just think if you're going to go into this industry, you set up properly, or if you can't afford a facility, you utilise a facility that someone has built that meets all the standards, and you're transparent. That's not yours, but you use this.
Yeah, I think transparency is key. Do you hope that, I mean, will this be a generational, quite often funeral directors, they're family businesses as well. Is this something that is beyond you, Carly?
Look, I would love for my children to want to work in the industry, but no, they don't. They've got other fun things they want to do with their life. Look, and both of them have worked in the business, and both of them are exceptionally good when they come along and work on funerals with us. Oh. They're amazing individuals. But I think they've got other things they want to do, so, and that's fine. But you know what? Greenhaven will roll along forever, and, you know, whoever wants to take over the business from us one day will enjoy working.
Oh, you never know. They might change their mind, Carly. Carly, thank you. I know you've just been with the family, and that's just wrapped up. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Carly Dalton, who is the owner of Greenhaven Funerals. Just finally, Dr. Hannah Gould, will we ever see a time, do you think, where the funeral business will be regulated?
I think I have to be optimistic.
Yeah. Look, we're heading into an age of what's called peak death. We're going to have a lot more deaths in the future as the baby boomers get older and eventually, you know, will pass. And so I do think we're going to see more and more, unfortunately, of stories of kind of bad funeral experiences and bad deaths if there is no regulation. So I can only hope, and, you know, certainly I'll be working my hardest to ensure that we do have regulations put in place and standards put in place so this doesn't happen in the future.
Peak death, there's another term alongside, you know, morgues and abattoirs that I've underlined today as a part of the conversation I didn't think I'd have. Always good to get your thoughts, Hannah. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
See you. Dr. Hannah Gould, cultural anthropologist and works with the Death Tech Research Team at Melbourne University. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.